The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's program, we're searching for answers to all of the questions you've ever asked the internet. The how, the who, the why, the what now, and yes, the what next. Joining me is the technology editor of The Guardian, Charles Arthur. Welcome to the podcast, Charles.
Well, hello.
And Charles, specifically, we're going to be asking what's next for Bing, Microsoft's search facility. And here to join in the Q&A is Microsoft's director of search for the UK, David Coplin. Welcome to the studio, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, it was Twitter's five-year birthday this week, guys. And to commemorate this event, given that Twitter, for me, has become a bit overwhelming, I've realized that I follow far too many people. I need your top two Twitter must-reads so that I can get rid of all of the excess and just really get to the nuggets. Charles.
It's so unfair. Okay, well, I guess it would have to be the Guardian technology feed, Guardian Tech.
That was a really shameless plug, Charles.
You've got to know whether the machine is working or not. You know, you have to know whether actually the turbines are turning in the back. I guess I'd have to follow my wife as well.
So you've got the job and the home life to get well done.
It's a work-life balance.
Isn't it? Okay, so I'm going to follow your wife and I'm going to follow the Guardian's technology feed. Now, Dave, what are your two?
So I've got two for you. One of them won't actually help you with cutting down on the noise. So the one that I think is really good is Guy Kawasaki. So just fantastic, but incredible breadth. And so you kind of have to dip in and dip out for his stuff. And then the second, just for fun, is the Queen_UK. Just superb. Little snippets every day to make you smile.
She was actually one of the top, I think it was six, tweeters that were profiled in the media section.
Is that right?
Yeah. As well as the podcast and The Guardian's own Jemima Kish. I've got two that I really like, and they're very psychology focused. One is Research Digest, which is the psychologist's, the BPS's official feed. And then the other is a guy named Vaughn Bell, who's a journalist. He's a neuropsychologist who writes about fascinating things to do with mind hacks and all kinds of crazy things that the brain does. So those are my two recommendations. And we'll be finding out more about how services like Twitter are impacting services like Bing later on in the program. But also on Tech Weekly, the latest on Ed Vasey and Tim Berners-Lee's collaboration and recommendations for ISPs about the future directions that they should take to ensure net neutrality. All this and more on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. A high-powered debate took place last week in Westminster to determine the direction of the future of the web. So, small change. Under the lens was net neutrality, an issue currently dealing with the proposed restriction of bandwidth-heavy websites that hog the spectrum. How does net neutrality affect you? Well, at the moment, we're relatively free of restrictions that could be placed upon our internet access, regardless of the amount of spectrum that we use. All sites are effectively equal, but ISPs could add an extra fee to your monthly broadband bill if, for example, you want to watch spectrum-heavy hoggers like iPlayer or a YouTube video. Sir Tim Berners-Lee was at the roundtable, along with content creators like Facebook and Skype. ISP representatives were there, and regulators, of course. The inventor of the web warned Communications Minister Ed Vasey against a two-tiered system, saying that it worked against the principles that have allowed the web to grow over the past two decades. Also at the roundtable was Jim Killick from the Open Rights Group, the organization there representing the consumer. Now, Jim joins us down the line. Welcome to the podcast, Jim. Now, why was this roundtable convened? What was different this time?
Basically, there's legislation coming down the track. So Europe last year looked at the question of how networks are managed and brought in some new rules which are going to shortly be in UK law. And that means that the UK has actually got to think about how traffic management occurs and introduce rules about transparency. So that if internet service providers start discriminating against traffic or stopping certain things working on your internet connection, they're now going to be obliged to tell you about it. What didn't happen in the European debate and was disappointing to organizations like us was that there was no real sense about how internet service providers would really be stopped from discriminating against services and you know how it would be that we really do keep the internet open. The legislation just made a pretty blasé assumption, really, that if customers found that BT or TalkTalk or whoever were doing things on to their internet connection that they didn't like, that they'd walk with their feet. So as long as people knew what was happening, that would be fair enough, because competition would stop everything from getting really terrible. Of course, internet service providers do their absolute best to stop people from switching their internet accounts and changing providers. So we don't really think this is going to work. And nor, frankly, do lots of internet companies who depend on being able to get to BT or whoever's customers and are really, really worried that this is going to affect their businesses or affect the businesses of the future.
What are specifically some of the issues that you feel were ignored in this debate?
Well, the bottom line is, if people start changing the way the internet works, then we're not going to have the competitive, innovative internet that we're used to. We're going to find instead that new services don't work, or that people we want, you know, if we want to do video conferencing or whatever it happens to be, that the perhaps the people that we want to communicate with, we might not be able to communicate with them properly because discrimination has been put in place between, or you know, on one or other of our internet connections. So we could really lose the innovative and, you know, hugely changing and great platform that the internet is. That could really change. It could become much more locked down and much more like a series of walled gardens where we're having to pay for new things rather than having, you know, being able to get at whatever we like because we have an internet that's an open platform.
Do you feel that the ISPs are willing to engage in a debate, to have a conversation?
Well, they were very reluctant. I mean, Simon Milner from BT said, you know, if internet service providers want to block sites, then why shouldn't they be able to? And he gave the example later in the press of a Christian ISP blocking sites that they found offensive. And, you know, for us, I mean, I think that there's a simple answer to this. If people want to do that, if they want to create walled gardens, fair enough, but they shouldn't be able to call it the internet and they shouldn't be able to sell it as the internet. People should be told, no, you're getting a really restricted package and it is not, you may not be able to do what you want.
Charles, how do you feel that the results of this debate, the results of this roundtable have moved anything forward?
Well, I think it was more that it got Ed Vasey to realise that actually there's a lot more to the issue than he thought there was. I mean, Tim Berners-Lee was very clear that what there should really be is that any content can reach any customer and any customer can reach any content, that there should be this ability to get between the two. But, you know, let's make no mistake. Actually, traffic management already happens. If you're using a mobile internet connection, mobile carriers, for one thing, will say, well, we think certain websites are adult websites and you have to do an age verification before you can get onto them. And organizations like Skype, which was represented there, say, well, we can't actually be used over any mobile internet connection apart from that provided by Three, you know, O2, Vodafone, Everything Everywhere. They block us over mobile internet. So we'd like to know why. So, you know, there's no net neutrality in mobile, and to some extent, the European Commission has completely dropped the ball on this one. They haven't actually said that there should be something resembling it. And when it comes to fixed line broadband, there's a lot of grumbling from the ISPs about the fact that there are these allegedly, you know, data heavy things like iPlayer, which is of course the thing that most upsets them because it's so enormously popular. The amount of data that gets moved over it is just colossal. And they don't like it because they have to pay BT. That problem's probably only going to get worse as you get faster lines. What really needs to happen is, I think that actually, Ed Vasey needs to really think about it a little bit. And that you really need a situation where if we're going to talk about this sort of halfway house where ISPs say, oh yeah, we block Skype and we block, or we slow down these things and we slow down iPlayer. Well, then consumers need to be able to say, right, well, tomorrow I'm going and then I'm going to join X over there. I think it's interesting just to contrast it with what Ofgem, the electricity regulator, said earlier this week, which was there's gazillions of electricity supply companies, but you can't understand the tariffs, and it's very difficult to switch. Exactly the same pertains to ISPs, except with knobs on, because you might be tied into a 12-month, 18-month contract.
Jim, Charles mentioned sort of the wider view of, we're not just looking at communications here. We're not just looking at the European Union. And you made a comment afterwards, after the debate, that the proposals in the UK are actually different from the proposals that are on tables in other countries. What do you feel that the UK should take from some of the proposals that are being laid out, for example, in the United States?
Well, the short and long of it is that in other countries, the ISPs are saying, we don't want to act anti-competitively. We don't want to start abusing other people in the market. What we have is a problem that sometimes the traffic gets congested, and we do need to correct that. And they therefore have sort of put forward principles where they're saying, we won't act anti-competitively, we won't discriminate against whole classes of traffic. We will attempt to make the internet as open as practical. And then that's something where you can actually measure what they're doing against that. So they could be doing that. That's what's happened in Norway and in other countries. People have acted to say, we will just self-regulate and we'll make sure this doesn't become a problem. In other countries like France, the regulators said, let's see some clear rules where we're not going to get these anti-competitive blocking of services and so on. And if you can't manage to convince us that you're really going to not do evil things, then we will impose minimum service guarantees, so which they're able to do under the European legislation. There is actually a means to introduce some regulation to stop network discrimination. And I think this is perhaps where Ed Vasey needs to toughen up a little. Obviously, he's a conservative, and lots of people on the right, they have an instinctive, very reasonable dislike of regulation and heavy-handed government rules that then create unwanted consequences and maybe stop quite reasonable things from happening. But really, if you're going to say, well, we won't regulate as a state, we won't impose rules on industry, you have to be able to know that industry is going to behave itself. So if they want self-regulation, really they have to say, come up to the mark, show us that you're going to do the right thing and you're not going to create a series of walled gardens and stop innovation and block competitors and all the rest of it. And if you can't show us that you're not going to do that, then we will regulate.
Jim, I guess I've got two questions for you. The first is, do you think in the UK we're doing enough to look at global best practice? The example I read a lot about is what the Canadians did with their sort of authority in this space, the CRTC. And I think, to Charles, to your point, they went on a similar journey. They started treating mobile differently, saying it was okay to do this mobile but not on fixed line. They then rescinded that and said, no, actually, it's all the same. So do you think we're doing enough to get to look at what's happening in the global stage? And then the second question is about Tim Berners-Lee. Do you think he's the right guy for this? Do you think people, certainly from the ISP industry, will see him as the father of internet and therefore got a vested interest in how that plays out?
On the international best practice, clearly we're not doing enough. We could be learning from other people. Everyone's got the same problem here. We could be looking at our European colleagues, or we could, as you say, be looking at Canada or Norway. Yes, we could be doing that, and perhaps we haven't started that. And I think at the moment there's a sort of tension between what the new political masses, the new Ed Vasey and so on, want Ofcom to be, whether they really want a strong Ofcom that acts on principle, or whether they actually want to be making the decisions themselves. There's a bit of a grey area there, I think, and that is adding to this in the debate. But yes, we need to engage in that. We need to actually see those questions being raised properly. On the Tim Berners-Lee question, I think there is some chance that they will sort of see him as being too principled and not being close enough to their interests. But the fact is, he is somebody with immense stature. He's got, I think, a very clear idea of why we have an internet, why it is that content needs to be shareable, and why protocols are at the heart of this. So I think, and he's obviously well known across Britain. So I think in many ways he is the right person. But I think it also needs to be clear that that Tim Berners-Lee is going to be listened to politically, because if he doesn't have that political support, then he could find his position being very weak. So I think, you know, this is early days for all of us. We don't really know how this is all going to pan out, but I'm very personally very glad to see Tim Berners-Lee involved and being put in the, at the heart of this at the moment.
Well, thanks very much, Jim. There's more on net neutrality on Tech Weekly. You can check out last week's interview with Tim Wu. Find it in your podcast feed or at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Also in this week's news, ICANN has approved a new web address suffix, .xxx. The international body has been wrestling with the release of the .xxx name registration domain for some time. But, Charles, what effect do they hope that it will have, and what effect will it actually have?
What they hope is that it will lead to all of the porn sites all over the web, all upping sticks and migrating to .xxx, there to be the most incredible concentration of porn ever seen in the entire history, possibly of the galaxy and the universe.
Is it going to implode
the web?
It would
be like a sort of a black hole of porn.
Oh, God, you didn't just say that.
This is possibly the wrong thing. Which would have such gravity. It would. Oh no, I won't go any further. Okay. What effect will it actually have? Well, it will probably mean that all the websites presently on .com and .org and everywhere else will stay exactly where they are. That they might buy the .xxx version and redirect to their .com sites. And that the people who are the registrars, the UK-based person behind the .xxx registrar, will make a big lot of money.
Yeah, at the same time, I think that, David, when it comes to search facilities, you know, porn should ostensibly be at the top of any search engine that has been optimized, right? Because there's so much of it and people are searching for it. But somehow you guys filter it out. And I imagine that the porn industry is not too pleased with the idea of having, a silo where they're automatically going to be filtered. Is this how you guys would filter your porn content, by looking at .xxx and saying, sorry, you're not invited to our party?
Well, it's not so much that. It's more about giving people on the end of the search what they're looking for, the choice, right? So there are people who want to find that sort of stuff, and so we need to make sure that they can find that stuff where it's legal and appropriate and all that sort of stuff. But equally, there's a huge population of people who aren't looking for that stuff, and because of the way the internet works, they end up getting presented with that. My favorite example of this, I walked into my son's school. In the ICT lab, there is a poster on the wall, and it says in big letters, "Do not use search engines. If you're looking for content, ask a teacher." Now, remember, primary school, right? So, but to me, that's an indication of the problem, because we can't trust the way that search works. We can't trust the way the internet works enough. We have to put this human intervention in. So as a parent, as a geek dad, you know, I want my kid to be able to use the internet and technology for great things, not be constrained by that sort of stuff. So we have to do more. And I think, you know, this may be a hollow gesture. It's a good step in the right direction to at least start down that path of providing the appropriate way to segregate it, just like we do in analog society. You know, that we have a way of managing that in society today. We have the 9 p.m. watershed. We have, age restrictions, all that sort of stuff. Why wouldn't we have that in the digital equivalent?
But that's also in a country where, you know, I'm thinking, looking at the U.S., where you can see anything at any time because, you know, there are three or four different time zones and whatever. So you don't, in this system, in the U.K. system, we've got a very, almost a societally recognized system in which we've got a watershed. But, you know, we've got a XXX domain name, and how is that governmentally, Charles, going to be affected by what can come in and out of the country? Surely the government would say, well, we don't want porn, as they've said before, or we don't want inappropriate content. We're just going to block everything that's a XXX domain.
It's sort of difficult because, you know, there's lots of, you know, porn is not in itself illegal.
In this country,
and well, in lots of countries, actually. There's a question of, well, so, you know, one man's, often one religion's porn is another religion's or another, you know, secular society's. I can't see what on earth you're objecting to there. The XXX thing ranges far and wide, and no one has actually said, well, what are the limits on it? And obviously you don't want to have something which is agreed to be internationally unwanted, such as child pornography. But then you run into all sorts of things like, well, you know, your age limit is different from their age limit, and can it be on here? And which results do you show to these people here? It's the sort of thing which is, you know, a nightmare. Not that it wasn't already a nightmare, but having a XXX domain is not going to make all the porn sites up up sticks and head over there saying, hey, there's a great new party in town. They just don't. You know, every time that a new suffix is released by ICANN, lots of porn companies and lots of spamsters all head over there and do lots of registrations because they figure it's an easy way to make money. You know, and it works both ways. It works with porn sites, it works with scamsters, it works with the registrars. But it doesn't actually mean that you or I benefit. So the .info suffix has not actually turned out to be the most incredibly fantastic resource for people to put lots of .infos into. It's turned out to be a haven for spammers and porn people.
I can actually imagine a whole bunch of college students sprinting over to .xxx and getting their name .xxx for laughs and giggles. But you can read up on these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. It's not flippant to suggest that search is the killer app of the World Wide Web. Before search, the web was an unnavigable field of opportunity. Users needed to know exactly where they were going in order to get there. And so it's unsurprising that search has become one of the most contested areas of online business, dominated in the West by heavy hitter Google. But although Google has topped the leaderboard since the early 2000s, keeping itself relevant with service buyouts, diversification into mail and other office applications, and regular tweaks of its highly protected algorithm, other companies like Microsoft have taken different approaches to the search facility. We've been speaking, obviously, throughout the entire podcast with Dave Coughlin, Microsoft's Director of Search in the UK, who we hope now, Dave, you will shed some light on your plans for the future of web navigation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Search is a really big business, but its relationship with customers has changed over the years. As I mentioned, you know, I used to have to go directly to the one site that I knew, and that was really my only point of entry for the web before search really made the web what it is now. Can you just give me a brief history of how our relationship as consumers has changed because of search?
Yeah, absolutely. Search has gone from this tool that used the way that the internet was designed, the whole HTML thing, a series of hyperlinks and all that sort of stuff. And broadly, that's gone unchanged for years and years and years. And yet we live in a world where the internet is actually this really rich source of not just information, but things like social sentiment, multimedia, and all those sorts of things. And yet we're still kind of searching it in an old-fashioned way. And increasingly what we're looking at is search is no longer this way that you find information. It's increasingly the, if you like, the user interface for the internet. It's the way, it's the portal, the way in which you extract value from all that the internet has to offer. And if you take that perspective, you start to end up in a different place as to the future and, you know, the direction that you need to take and the services that become increasingly important. So we try and take a step back and think, when people are looking for terms, when they're inputting queries, what is it that they're actually trying to do? Not the explicit query, but actually, so what's the task? What's the decision that you're trying to make behind it? And that's really the thing that we're trying to do.
It's almost their intentions. I've heard Google is a sort of intention engine. I've heard people describe it as an oracle in some ways. Yeah. But that's how they've monetized it. You're talking actually more about providing value back
Absolutely.
To customers.
Absolutely. And bringing up, you know, intent is really key. And, you know, the search industry back in 2007 talked about, you know, three domains of intent. So what is it that the user's actually trying to do at any given point in time? Those three are navigational search. So, you know, my son's a classic example of this. He's into Scooby-Doo. So he's five. He can't remember how the URL gets made up. You know, he doesn't know. He's just five. So he'll go in, he'll put in Scooby-Doo. It takes him to the Scooby-Doo website. Navigational search, navigational intent. Then there's informational intent. So actually, there's a particular topic I'd like to know a lot more about. And so again, my son will be, you know what, in season 4, episode 3 of Scooby-Doo, Scooby has a particular unique kind of Scooby snack. I'd like to know what that is. Informational intent, and the internet being what it is, will answer that question. And then the third is about commercial intent. And commercial intent is transactional intent. There's a number of things within that. Some of it's commercial, so I want to buy Scooby-Doo season 4 box set, whatever. Or I want to set up an email account, or I want to do something that will enable me to do some other activity on the web. The problem with that theory is it treats all of those activities as really transactional and as separate things. And if you think about how we are as human beings, actually, and change the analogy to something more realistic now about maybe I want to book a holiday, right? Well, so first of all, I want to find out where am I going to go? You know, what sort of place do I want to be? I want to find about more about the place itself, and then I want to book tickets. Now, I don't want to do that as a series of transactions. I actually want to do that as one joined up exercise. And I think increasingly when we talk about user intent, it's we will be more successful if we're able to join up those different elements to make sense of that and to really get the user nearer to where they want to be.
Now, of course, as the web has evolved and as our use of it has evolved, we've seen different services jumping in for exactly those three elements. Some people would argue that, you know, the informational aspect is covered by Wikipedia.
Yeah.
You know, and so now we've started to see an evolution. How do you see Bing joining up those three? Again,
well, you know, again, our job is not so much just to bring you, you know, the best results back, but also to try and get you that step further. So actually bringing you the answers in the search results page itself. So, you know, really trivial but important examples. You know, if I type in London weather to Bing, you know, it brings me back the link to the BBC weather pages and the Met Office, but it also brings me a little pop-up to say, oh, by the way, this is the weather in London for the next few days. It's just a very simple example of how we're trying to bring content back into the search results page, as well as take you into links. So again, trying to get you that step further on in being able to make the decision that you try to make.
One of the elements that I have the greatest concern with search, whatever the facility is the, in many ways, the lack of transparency. I don't actually know what your sources are. Right. And those sources that you draw from, whatever your algorithm is just literally the icing on the cake. The dark web exists beneath. And I want to know what's underneath because I want the breadth of information and not just that which you, Bing or Google or Dogpile or whoever tells me is what I should be looking at. So how are you going to create that kind of engine? How are you going to tap in to the dark web? Do you have monkeys picking out the best of the darkness and bringing it up to the surface manually?
Of course we do. Good, I hope so. Doesn't everybody have monkeys?
I certainly hope so. No animals were harmed in the making of
search engine. These are all well looked after monkeys. So yeah. Now, and you know, that's really hard, right? So remember that, you know, any algorithm, search algorithm is based on a really complicated series of signals. You know, in our case, it's like over 1,000 different signals. Each one has a different weight in terms of how we bring back the relevancy of the results. But if I try and answer your question a slightly different way, what you're really looking for is an ability to better trust the results. When I bring you back some answers, if I can improve the extent to which you trust those results, then actually you net out in a similar sort of area. And that's where the whole social signal comes in. And you know, the example that we're doing, Google are doing it too, where basically if I can blend in the social signal, the sort of the, if you like, the byproduct of all of our social communication, and blend that in with the relevancy of the results, then I've got a trust bar that I can use for those results. And again, just really sort of trivial example, but if I search on sushi restaurants now, any good search engine will give me the 10 nearest sushi restaurants. That's okay, but how do I know if they're any good? How do I know which is expensive, which is cheap, and all that sort of stuff? If I bring in the search signal, in this example, it might just be as basic as bringing in Facebook likes. I know that if you're my friends on Facebook and you said, actually, of the 10 nearest, this is the one we like, now I've got an element of trust in those results. Even if I think your taste in sushi sucks, you know, it's still a baseline against which I can make my decision as which place I'm going to go.
But this is the difficulty, isn't it, is knowing which social signals to read, because I can see that yes, you want to go beyond the sort of the initial Google thing, which is rather based on the scientific recommendation model, which where if a paper gets referenced a lot, that means it's a great paper, and that's the way that Google set up its search. And you want to go a bit beyond that because we're all feeding all these things into Twitter and Facebook and all the other sort of social networks. So you want to get some sort of idea of sentiment in there. But equally, you know, if Alex likes the sushi restaurant, maybe I don't like, you know, how do I know, you know, if Alex is in my sort of Facebook likes and things like that, how do you separate this out? Or is this a sort of unknowable thing without just interviewing everyone individually?
It's, I mean, if I understand your point correctly, Charles, I mean, the thing for me is really you know, you have a relationship with Alex. You know about Alex. You may like her or dislike her, but that's a baseline to which you have control over and you understand. So if it brings back a result from some kind of social sentiment that says Alex is recommending this, you've got some judgment you can make based on your relationship with her to say whether that's good or bad for you. And I think it's this you know, it's this cliche about sort of human decisions need human input, and the mechanical algorithm can only ever get you so far. And what we need to avoid, and I know this is a topic that sort of you've talked about in the past, but we could take this to an extreme, right? And we could be into the world of machine learning, and I could have a search engine that knows everything about me and knows that when I search on a specific kind of motorbike, it's only going to bring back BMWs, or that I like beer and crisps, or whatever, because that's what it's learnt about me. But then where's the role of serendipity in that?
Where ding, is it? Yeah. Ding, ding. Yeah. You read my questions, didn't you? Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, this is, I think, really important and draws on what Charles was suggesting, is that if we are filtering, if we're increasingly filtering our information gathering, whether you're doing it or whether we're doing it via Twitter or Facebook, of this massive content online, but we're only doing it through our friends, we're not necessarily getting the depth and the breadth of the information that's out there. How do you propose to create a serendipity engine that gets as relevant but as interesting information that people wouldn't expect?
Well, I think that the thing that we forget often when we talk about search is we're so focused on getting the results right, we forget about the other side of search, which is all about discovery. So it's the kind of thing, you know what, I got half an hour to kill, I'm just going to search for stuff and see where I end up. And that's actually a big part of what we do. Are you not familiar with having half an hour to kill?
Well, there's that, yeah.
I've got to say, if it was me, then I had the half an hour to spare, I wouldn't spend it feeding a search box. I'd spend it on Twitter, because that would be the serendipity thing, because I think I follow enough people that they would just send me to all sorts of places.
Yeah, and maybe the example wasn't good enough. What I'm talking about is if you've got time, it's kind of like you want a serendipity filter, right? So there are points in my life where I'm like, you know what, I just need to know the bloody answer. Don't send me place, I just need to know, and then I can get on with my life. And then there are other times is when I'm researching a topic wherever, and I'd want to turn that serendipity filter right up and say, you know what, surprise me a bit in this stuff. I may be looking for this particular topic, but be a bit less relevant for me. Give me something that's related that will send me in a different direction, because I want to discover some stuff. And I think it's really important not to lose that concept of discovery as we talk about making search more relevant and better and all that, and faster and all that sort of stuff.
And those aspects of trust, of course.
Absolutely.
Now, one of the dangers, though, associated with everything that we're talking about here, and you've alluded to it, is in many ways just tracking people across the web, right? You want to, basically, what you want to do is you want to follow me, you want to follow Charles, you want to follow our producer Scott, you want to follow Jemima, you want to follow everybody so that you can then provide them with the most relevant results. There's a huge issue of privacy there. And in fact, there's a huge issue of privacy across the board when it comes to search. So when it comes to the privacy of what you want to do in terms of track us, how are you guys dealing with that? And then we'll deal with the other issue of privacy in a second.
So in terms of what we're dealing with, we're only dealing with the public information, right? So even when we have the Facebook integration, that's the stuff that in your profile have said, you know, that's in the public domain. So we're using publicly available information from that perspective.
But Microsoft also got a relationship with Facebook, so you could probably dig a little bit beneath the surface as well.
We do, but, you know, why would we do that? That's not going to help us in what we're trying to do. And privacy is really important to us. I mean, and not just for some bit of frippery that we bolt on at the end to say, yeah, we do privacy too. Actually, it's embedded in our DNA. We have this religion called privacy by design that's built into everything that we do. No product gets developed without going through four levels of privacy review as part of its development lifecycle. It's not something that, you know, you have to call in the privacy guys just as you come in out of beta and it's like, have we done the right thing? And so for us, even with something like Facebook, where this is very close to that, it's absolutely paramount that we get this right. And privacy is not about, avoiding eroding privacy, because there are some times when it may be beneficial. And you know, the challenge with privacy, as we all know, is we'll each have a different definition of what privacy is to us as an individual. So I can't provide, it's not like security where I can provide a baseline that's secure or not secure. We have to provide you with a slider, but be transparent in how we do that. And that's the key. And I think that's where poor Facebook has ended up with this stuff. They've tried to do the right thing. They've made it really transparent, but now you've got 500 plus settings and, you know, nobody can. So we're on a journey with this stuff. And that's the thing we have to remember. So it's doing it with responsibility and with respect for the resource that we're being able to use, and being transparent and open and having that conversation with people.
Where does search go next? Because, I mean, you've sort of described this, but I can, you know, we've had 10, 13, 15 years of it. You know, the only big breakthrough that I can think of actually in search is what Google did, the ranking system,
right?
Which is now starting to break down. You know, if you do start looking for a fridge or a holiday on Google, you'll have to wade your way through dozens of rubbish websites. I have to admit I haven't tried it very often on Bing, but you know, the problem is an endemic one, isn't it? Which is that spam is it's the E. coli of the internet. You know, you can't get rid of it because you'd have such a sterile environment there'd be nothing there.
So I think there's a number of places we go. One is, and this is further out, right, but back to the privacy conversation that we've had. As a society, both our definition of privacy and the way in which we choose to manage it as individuals will evolve. So we will continue to have debates about privacy, but I think we will be more accustomed to them. We hopefully will move away from some of the sensationalist headlines that we get into today that just deflects from the conversation that we need to have. The second thing, back to the user intent piece, is I think search is heading in a place that starts to join up that intent. So the more effective I can be about joining those intent, providing you with that experience. And Chilu, our head of online services, is really good talking about this. And his concept is what he wants is something that he calls loosely the Friday night thing, where he just basically says, you know what, Friday night, want to go see a movie. I'd like to go out for a dinner with my wife, probably Mexican. I want to be home by 10 o'clock. Figure it out. And search comes back and it knows enough about Chi or the individual to say, right, so here's the kind of movies that you'd like. This is the place you'd want to go. Next to that is the restaurant. Here's how you're going to get there and here's how you get home by 10 o'clock, kind of as a single event. So joining those things up. So it's kind of a trivial example, but it shows how those things join together. The final piece is, and this is the challenge with intent and how it bleeds into privacy, is the more I know about you as an individual, the better I can be at serving more relevant results. Now, I can harvest that information covertly, not great, or I can do it overtly. And again, we're back into this societal response to privacy. So the only other way you've got is the social signal. And that's where, you know, certainly what we're doing a lot today, that sort of not so much bypasses the privacy problem, but it at least postpones it to a time where, as a society, we're more ready to deal with it.
Regarding point number three, there's not just you who wants to know that information. You've got an enormous trove of information on individuals. And Google, for example, has been outspoken about how it doesn't want to deliver its results, its databases to governments. It's also made a big song and dance about the fact that, you know, they're concerned about their relationship with China because China's feels that they need to have access, that they have a right to have access. Microsoft is not pulled out of China, and you have also delivered databases to the government. What's that relationship? How are you defining that, and where does the user fit into that?
Well, I mean, so first of all, we only deliver that stuff when legally required to do so, right? So, you know, you don't get to turn up and say, oh, could we have a look? And we go, yeah, all right, come on. You know, that doesn't happen. So it's within those parameters. We take a very different approach to how we store individuals' data. So, for example, your search stream as you come to Bing gets instantly separated. So anything that is personally identifiable gets encrypted and pushed over somewhere else. And the stuff that's important to us, what you've been searching for, how you've been using it, where you've clicked, the stuff that everybody uses to make their search engines better gets put in a different place. So there's no reference between the two. And we keep the personal stuff for 6 months, then it gets burned. And then we keep the search signal for 12 months.
I'm writing a book about Microsoft and Apple and Google and the various business battles they've had down the years. And one of the key ones, obviously, is Microsoft and Google and the whole rise of search from 2000 onwards. And it's very interesting because Microsoft had a big project, a sort of crash project to get in once they saw what Google was doing at the sort of beginning of 2003 called Project Underdog. At the time, once that was launched, the worldwide search share was in the sort of low teens. Now Microsoft's share of search worldwide is in the below tens. Why is it going in the wrong direction, and how will you get it going in the wrong direction?
You have to understand where the search industry has come on that journey as well. And at the time, we had a higher market share with the previous products. It was also at a time where there were many more players in the marketplace as well. And so for us, we're on a great journey. We're growing monthly now in terms of our market share. The alliance with Google makes big inroads
with
to that.
Yahoo. Alliance with Google, that'd be news.
Fantastic, yeah. And the alliance with Yahoo takes us much, much further towards that. But I think the other thing that's happened with us as an organization is that, you know, for me, there are two sides to the coin of search. There's the it's a revenue stream side, and many organizations treat it purely as that. We can make a bunch of cash if we do this, serving ads, being a media company, whatever. The other side that I'm much more interested in, the side that we're really waking up to, is the side where, you know, we talked about it earlier, search is the user interface for the internet. You know, it's not just something where we search and retrieve information. It's how we access value. And if you take that approach, that sort of, it's almost a philosophy, then what becomes important when you start talking about the future of search is not so much what you're going to do next, but it's actually your point of origin. And that's why at Microsoft we feel that we've got such a breadth in terms of what we do and how we've used technology to enable society to do great things with technology. We can deliver more by taking all of that to market and using and basically delivering it through the focal point of search.
But at the same time, recently Microsoft was accused by Google of bringing its search results directly, sort of cutting and pasting and bringing its search results over to Bing and presenting them as its results.
Yeah.
That was embarrassing.
Not embarrassing, no. It was a very interesting experience to watch unfold, actually. And I really felt for my counterparts in the US, because the day that they envisioned was basically, let's get together a bunch of leaders from the industry and let's talk about the future of search, where it's going. Google chose that opportunity to talk about some research that they'd be doing, let's put it that way, which use things that we call extreme outliers. So, you know, really random bits of data, small amounts of data. And again, back to the point where search engines use these multiple thousands of signals to build that algorithm, that we track what people do like anybody else does. You know, we use different influences. And the fact that we got picked up in, I think it was 7 out of the 100 honey traps that they'd led, to then come to the conclusion that Google did, I think was interesting and spoke to a number of things, I think. So Google are genuinely interested in what Bing are doing. They see that sort of competition growing, and that's a great confirmation for us that we're obviously doing the right thing. And it also, it shows how sort of nefarious the industry is. And so you want to talk about copying and cheating. Well, you know, it's a competitive industry. That's what it should be. So we do stuff that Google copies. You know, we're interested in what they do. We want to see where the direction they're taking, and that influences what we do. That's kind of what a competitive market is, without getting into, you know, I think some of the proposition was around industrial espionage, and I think that's probably a step too far from what I saw.
Well, find out more about search at guardian.co.uk and enjoy surfing the web with Bing. That's it for this week. I'd like to thank our in-studio guests, David Coplin and Jim Killick, who is down the line. Thanks also to the podcast team, Charles Arthur on the mic and Scott Colley, the producer behind the scenes. Next week, we're finishing up our occasional series on the Indian web scene with a visit to HP Labs and a look at the ridiculously popular mobile social network in India, Rocket Talk. I'm Alex Kratosky. Thanks for listening. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.